It was largely academic from this point. A single AGM-114R Romeo Hellfire II missile locked on immediately, flying toward the lased target as if on a wire. Traveling at 995 miles per hour, it took just over 7 seconds to make the trip. Zamil and the others were in the process of unloading the Mistrals and pulled the tarp a little farther, displaying the rest of the Toyota's contents the instant before the Romeo turned them to a flaming ball of fire and dust. A secondary explosion, really a series of them that happened almost too fast to distinguish, touched off just after the initial splash. Hyatt watched the wind blow away smoke and dust. "Master arm off," Brian said. "Weapons safe." "Laser safe," Detheridge said. Brian sat still for a moment. "Did you see that?" Captain Hyatt said. "The secondaries." Brian gave a low whistle. "I know, right?" "That too," Hyatt said. "I'm going to rewind the video feed a little. I think he had some micas." "French micas?" Brian stood now, unplugging his headset and making way for Hyatt. "Pretty sure," the captain said. "I call that a well-armed enemy," Brian said. "French Mistrals. French micas. I'd like to know where they're getting their shit." "That's your battle space," Hyatt said. He set a course for Kandahar. The guys on the ground there would land the bird, perform any needed maintenance, and then do a refuel so she could jump up on station for another 10 to 12 hours. A few clicks of his keyboard later, the report and relevant video were on their way to Hyatt's commanding officer at Creech. She'd run it up the chain, where it would be reviewed and discussed every step of the way, before being sent to encrypted servers at Langley, the Pentagon, and the Director of National Intelligence's staff at Liberty Crossing, just to make sure all bases were covered. Brian put a friendly hand on Hyatt's shoulder. "Not to be a sociopath, Captain, but we did a good thing here. It needed to be done." Detheridge still had the cameras focused on the carnage of the kill site. "Yep," Hyatt said. He could get over the splashes, but he didn't get off on talking about them. "Done deal," he said. Brian took the hint. "What's that written on your hand?" Hyatt gave an embarrassed shrug. "A note to myself, so I don't forget something for my kid's birthday." He took a final look at the smoldering crater that had once been Faisal al-Zamil before he turned his palm upright. Balloons. Some terrible god of war he was. Chapter 4. If Portugal was the westward-looking face on a map of the Iberian Peninsula, then the pinnacled rocks and secret grottos of the Algarve coast made up the whiskers below a pointed and somewhat pensive chin. The coastal village of Benagil lay in a deep valley, equidistant from the coastal towns of Albufeira and Lagos to the east and west, respectively, one of countless whitewashed jewels on the limestone cliffs above a half-moon beach of honey-colored sand. The proximity to Africa made the Atlantic here seem almost, but not quite, like the Med. While tourism had certainly come to this tiny village of fewer than 3,000, Benagil still had a robust fishing fleet and boasted a charm reminiscent of a quieter, more innocent Portugal. This naivete made it an excellent location for Hugo Gaspar to conduct his business. There were enough tourists with money that the arms dealer did not have to go without the creature comforts to which he'd grown accustomed. The local gendarmerie, though intelligent enough, tended to attune themselves to car break-ins or burglaries at holiday villas. The mere idea of an international crime boss completely overwhelmed their radar. Gaspar had been down to this same beach 3 days in a row while he waited for the Russians to show up. He made the mistake of walking the 150 meters down the hill from his Mercedes on the first day. There was parking along the narrow road on the cliffs overlooking the sea, but the corpulent Frenchman was much too fond of fine wine and rich pastries. Walking more than a few meters aggravated his gout, and his heart, and his lungs, and the bone spurs on his heels. Worse than that, walking made him feel poor. Today he'd ordered his driver to drop him off near the handicapped parking spot, as close to the trail to the beach as possible. The driver would stay with the car while the other three accompanied him to the beach. One could not be too careful these days. Gaspar stripped off his loose shirt as soon as he got out of the Mercedes. He would have done it earlier, but his ponderous belly made much movement in the back seat problematic. He'd already changed into his swimsuit in the villa and stepped out of his trousers on the side of the road, throwing them into the car on top of his shirt. The suit, a small triangle of red spandex, would have been considered tiny even on a man of much smaller stature. Gaspar's belly hung low enough that a casual observer could be excused for thinking he wore nothing at all. Gaspar didn't care. He had little to prove, and enough money that he could even buy respect if anyone had a problem with the way he dressed. His meeting with the Russians was 2 hours away. The turquoise and cobalt water was much too cool to swim, but the air was a pleasant and a slightly unseasonable 25 Celsius. The cloudless sky made it feel even warmer. He would use the time waiting to work on his tan. Praia de Benagil was not an incredibly large beach. It could be packed with pale British tourists in the summer, but now, in May, he had the place almost to himself. A few climbers, probably Americans, scrambled up the rock cliffs to the east. A Nordic-looking couple with a small child braved the chilly water, splashing in the surf near three wooden fishing boats that lay on the sand on the western end of the beach, by the walkway up toward the village. Gaspar spied a slender woman in a black two-piece as he tromped along the beach, leaving splay-footed divots in the sand. She had staked her claim in the center of the beach. She lay provocatively on her back, her head propped up on a woven grass beach bag, the brim of an almost comically huge hat shielding her face while she read a paperback. Gaspar thought she might be a blonde, maybe with a splash of freckles across her nose, but the hat made it difficult to be sure. That did not matter to him. She was a leggy thing, with all the right swells and curves, and a minuscule suit that obviously meant she sought companionship. Anyone with a figure like that, who wore such tiny bits of cloth, was, well, looking for it. He would sit near enough to strike up a casual conversation and see where it progressed. The French were not animals. He was not an animal. Not any longer, having attained a certain amount of refinement with his newfound wealth. He would be discreet, smooth, the perfect gentleman. If that did not work, he would let her know how rich he was. Whatever method he employed, Hugo Gaspar intended to take this nubile creature to his villa by mid-afternoon. She could drink wine and eat chocolates while he met with the Russians, and then they would spend the evening together. It was a good plan. Gaspar was a man of vision, and he could envision it, every delectable moment. Gaspar's three bodyguards flanked him, gazing outward with the predatory looks he paid them for. Gaspar himself had carried a pistol most of his life, since his time as a thuggish youth running a string of 100-franc whores in the Bois de Boulogne. His lunatic mother, a prostitute and a heroin addict, had passed to him one single piece of worthwhile wisdom during her short life. A man who carries many keys may look important, but a truly important man hires someone to carry the keys for him. Now, having made enough money to buy all the whores in the park, Hugo Gaspar paid others to carry the guns. Sun glinted off the thick gold chain that nestled among the rolls of his fleshy neck. Lines of sweat dripped down his chest. He nodded at a spot 2 meters from the woman, standing by while two of his men laid out his towel. It was extra large, to provide coverage from the sand against his sizable breadth. The third bodyguard, a bulldog of a man with a nose flattened by many fights, eyed the young woman suspiciously. His name was Farin, and his threatening glare was certainly overkill. The woman had not approached them. They were setting up near her. And anyway, She could not be dangerous. She was so young, so deliciously breakable. "Relax," Gaspar said, loud enough for the young woman to hear. It would not hurt for her to know that Gaspar was a man in charge of other men. "This peach is nearly naked. What harm could she possibly bring to me?" She glanced up from her book, a mindless romance written in English, judging from the bare-chested muscle man on the cover, and then she looked away, pretending to ignore him. Faint parallel scars on her upper thigh, like a tribal initiation or ritual, became visible as Gaspar got closer. There was a story there, to be sure, and he would have it before the night was over. Gaspar situated himself on his belly, grunting a little as he wallowed a depression into the sand beneath his towel, enabling him to lie relatively level. Resting his jowls on stacked hands, he could ensure an even tan on his back while still gazing sideways at the young woman. "Are you American?" he asked, eyes half closed, sleepy from the radiation beating down from the sun and the exertion of walking 15 meters up the beach. She raised the brim of her hat and gave him a long look, as if considering whether or not to reply. "Dutch," she said. "Why do you ask?" "Your book is written in English," Gaspar said, and chuckled. "What do the English know of romance? French romances are much better, both in the writing and in the flesh." "You read a lot of romance novels, then?" the young woman asked. Gaspar shrugged. "It is a logical argument. The French language is a romance of the tongue. Just speak a few words of it, and you will see for yourself." "I am to assume you are French?" "Oui," he said. "Tu parles français?" She held up the thumb and forefinger of her free hand. "Un peu. A little. I prefer English." "Pity," Gaspar said. "Please rub my back with oil sounds much too forward in English." The young woman stifled a laugh. A good sign, to be sure. "You are certainly the bold one. I have a very important meeting in 2 hours. That allows me only a finite amount of time in which to meet you, dance around the niceties of social discourse, and then invite you to my villa before dinner." The woman lowered the book to her chest, still open, and cocked her head to one side, perfect brunette locks brushing tan shoulders. Not a blonde after all, but oh, the glorious freckles splashed across her nose. "Before dinner?" The young woman scooted into a sitting position, hugging exquisite knees. Gaspar could plainly see the lines of many scars along her thighs. An automotive accident, or possibly an athletic injury. He could picture her, splashed with freckles while she played football with the local boys. She may have been a garçon manqué, a tomboy growing up, but she was certainly all woman now. "I see no point in wasting time," Gaspar said. "As I mentioned, I have a meeting in 2 hours." She finally closed the book, but kept it clutched in her hand. "An important meeting, you said?" "I said very important meeting, to be precise." Gaspar rolled half up on his side so he could look more directly at the object of his conquest. A line of sand pressed into the edge of his belly where it had escaped the confines of the beach towel. He brushed it off with sausage fingers. 2 gold rings caught the sunlight. "No point in beating around the bush, or wasting time," the young woman said. "Quite," Gaspar said. "I am already rich, but this meeting will make me richer, I dare say, than anyone you have ever met." He leaned forward, looking back and forth from the sea to the cliffs before lowering his voice. "My meeting is with the Russians." "The Russians," the young woman said, wide-eyed, mocking him just a little. "All of them." "You are quite the forward girl," Gaspar said. She smiled playfully. No point in beating around the bush. She scooted across the sand on her knees, extending her free hand. I am Lucilla, she said. Gaspar brightened. A magnificent French name. Still on his side, belly and chest sagging toward the beach, he took her hand and kissed it. I am Hugo. Encantado. I thought you were French. When in Rome, Gaspar said. Or Lisbon. Gaspar's bodyguards perked up. Farin especially grew apoplectic about anything or anyone who got between him and his boss. But Gaspar waved them away. He'd warned them as soon as he'd seen the woman. Targeted her, really, that he wanted space, ordering them to keep watch from a comfortable distance of at least 20 meters away. Having bodyguards showed everyone he was rich. Bodyguards who treated him as if he might shatter at any moment only made him look frightened, weak. It was a delicate balance. Lucilla was close enough to smell now. Earthy, Gaspar thought, like warm rain. You are visiting Portugal? Gaspar said. Small talk, Lucilla said. I thought we were dispensing with such things. Touché, Gaspar said. Are you well and truly rich? The Frenchman smiled. More money than you could possibly imagine. Oh. Lucilla scrunched her freckled nose. When it comes to money, I can imagine quite a lot. Do you really want oil on your back? I do indeed, Gaspar said. And you will buy me dinner? Indeed. She leaned toward her bag. I have some oil here. Gaspar grabbed her by the toes, tan things, painted pink, and thought that his reflexes were still very good. You must use my oil, he said. Farine marched over an instant later, shoving a plastic bottle of suntan oil at the woman. It was greasy from recent use. Thank you, Gaspar said to Farine. Now go away. He released the woman's foot and let his face fall forward toward the towel. He turned slightly toward Lucille, words muffled. I know it may be difficult for you to comprehend, but it is possible to kill someone with poisoned suntan oil. He raised wildly overgrown eyebrows up and down. The process will be easier if you straddle me. Are you being serious? Lucilla knelt beside him. Poisoned suntan oil. He wallowed deeper into the sand, head on his hands again, squinting into the sun. There are people who do not like me very much. I find that difficult to believe, the young woman said. She threw her leg across his rump, climbing aboard to pour a line of oil onto the leathery folds below Hugo Gaspar's hairy shoulder blades. The book lay in the sand beside her right knee, within immediate reach. Chapter 5 Domingo Ding Chavez stood on the edge of the limestone cliff above the eastern end of the Praia de Benagil, eyes fixed at the small screen on the controller in Bartosz Midas Jankowski's calloused hands. She saw it, Chavez said, gritting his teeth. Relax, boss, Jankowski said. How about you exhibit a little faith? I'm telling you, she saw it. That's a big nope, Jankowski said, popping the P for emphasis. I'm keeping the bird in the sun. She didn't see anything but glare. Working the bird, a pocket-size unmanned aerial vehicle called a Snipe Nano, the retired Delta colonel swung his legs easily, as if he were sitting on a boat dock and not perched on the edge of a sheer 70-foot drop. He was tied in, but that little factoid didn't do much for Chavez's churning stomach. You better be right, Chavez said. The last thing we need is for some beach bunny to tip off the target that we have an eye in the sky. Chavez had let his hair grow out over his ears, as he often did on ops where he didn't want to look like the former Army NCO that he was. Even absent the military haircut, it was obvious to anyone with experience downrange that Chavez had been around the combat block. That wasn't exactly rare in this day and age. There were enough warfighters coming home who'd seen the elephant that he could at least blend in at the mall. Domingo Chavez was in that height range that tall people called short and short people called tall. Good genes and a lifetime of PT gave him an athletic build, even in his late 40s, an age his son reminded him was too old to die tragically young. JP was a good kid, but had he known the dangers his father faced for reals, yo, on a daily basis, he wouldn't have been such a smartass. Chavez and Midas had counted 4 bodyguards, 3 on the beach plus the guy guarding the vehicles, a gray Mercedes that served as Gaspar's limo, and a dark Peugeot they apparently used as a follow car. The rest of Ding's team was doing some bouldering this morning while they watched. Hiding in plain sight was the only way to operate in these small villages where there was a 100% chance that you'd run into your target a dozen times a day. Scrambling around the rocks allowed Chavez and his team to blend in, to be noticed for something other than what they actually were. Operatives from the campus. The off-the-books intelligence organization worked under the guise of the financial arbitrage from Hendley Associates, across the Potomac from D.C. Free climbing over the ocean was fairly safe, so long as you knew what you were doing. Chavez did not, so he spent his time at the top looking down, happy to keep his feet planted on the level. Hands and fingers were made for pressing triggers and slapping the shit out of bad guys, not hanging on to minuscule rock nipples on the face of some cliff. Still, he'd dressed to look the part. Nylon running shorts, a tank top, Scarpa approach shoes with sticky soles, and a harness for a small bag of climbing chalk. Midas was dressed much the same, while Jack Ryan Jr. worked his way up the rock face, shirtless, wearing skin-tight Lycra climbing shorts and pointy La Sportiva climbing shoes that made him look like some kind of ballet dancer. Chavez was just old enough that he would have looked like the creepy old dude in bicycle shorts had he tried for the same getup. Lizanne Robertson climbed with Jack, also wearing Lycra shorts, which she wore much better than Ryan did, and a black sports bra. Not officially a campus operative, the former Marine and police officer was the transportation coordinator and in-flight attendant for the campus Hendley Associates Gulfstream. Because she often pulled security when the plane set down in hostile situations, John Clark, director of operations, and Ding's father-in-law, folded her into tactical training sessions and range time. She had zero experience running surveillance detection or tailing a target, but she was as savvy as Chavez had ever seen. She was also an accomplished climber, often hitting the rock gym in Bethesda after an evening PT workout that left Chavez looking for the nearest couch and a cold beer. Lizanne's voice came over the net, as if she knew Ding was pondering her climbing skill. "I don't think either of them saw it," she said. "Told you so," Midas said, without looking up from the palm-sized controller. "I still have eyes on our arms-dealing asshole, and the girl is still clueless. You gotta learn to trust me, boss." Lucille Fournier used her left hand to distribute the oil, keeping her right hand dry. Clasping with her thighs, she leaned forward, digging into the fleshy back with her forearms and elbows now, paying particular attention to the base of the disgustingly flabby neck, searching for just the right spot. Gaspar's hair was well-groomed but longish, the dark curls reaching below his collar, had he been wearing a shirt. Good. That would help to hide what she had in mind. He moaned under her rough ministrations, his alligatored skin shining bronze in the sun. Look, Fournier thought, such a slob. Gaspar might have money, but he would never have class. But she laughed as though she were oh so lucky to be riding on this fat pig. She shot a quick backward glance under the crook of her arm, checking the location of the 3 bodyguards. As she suspected, they were behind her, slumping on the gunwales of a couple of fishing skiffs that were pulled up on the sand, more than 20 meters away. The black bottoms of her swimsuit had a small rip over her left cheek, and she was certain that all 3 men, including the more astute Farin, were completely mesmerized by the flexing muscles of her toned derriere, as the rib opened and closed and opened again, in concert with her movements. "Have you been in Portugal long?" she asked. Gaspar grunted in time to her kneading.
"Now you start the small talk."
She ignored the jibe.
"Do you know Sebastianismo?"
"I confess that I do not," he said.
"King Sebastião," she said. "He was also a rich man. Like you, he too had an important meeting, his against the Moors. Unfortunately, he was forever lost in the deserts of North Africa. The word Sebastianismo comes from that. A failed venture. Hope for something that can never be."
"Stop," Gaspar said, sounding pained. "Your history lesson depresses me."
"As you wish," she said. "But I do like the word. Sebastianismo."
She leaned forward now, kneading with her left arm, pressing her breast against Gaspar's back. Her right hand slipped into the paperback book at her knee and retrieved the MSP Derringer hidden in the hollowed pages. A whirring noise above her head, like a dragonfly, or a passing bullet, almost caused her to fumble with the pistol. She regained her composure and brought the gun up quickly before the bodyguards could see it, covering it with a cupped palm. Pistol secure, she turned, looking for the source of the noise, half expecting to see Farine standing there, ready to blow her head off.
Merde.
She released a pent-up breath. Nothing but a blinding sun.
Maybe it really was a dragonfly.
She willed her body to relax and become more fluid, and then returned to the task ahead. The Soviet-era Mogabaritne Speciálny Pistolet fit her hand perfectly. Better, in fact, than the Beretta she customarily carried. The small special pistol had first seen action with KGB units in the early 1970s. Its specialized ammunition utilized a captive piston inside the brass casing that drove a 7.62 by 37 projectile, similar to that of an AK-47, out a short barrel at a speed just shy of 500 feet per second. The gases from the detonated propellant, and nearly all the resulting noise, remained trapped inside the cartridge, rendering the MSP very close to Hollywood quiet. The ballistics were quite limp, something around half of the diminutive 32 auto. But the Russians had proven many times over the last four decades that a Spitzer bullet delivered at point-blank range more than made up for the round's middling performance. Lucilla leaned forward slightly, digging in with her elbow to draw a grunt of pleasure from Gaspar. She nodded to herself. That would be plenty loud enough to cover the noise. He groaned.
"Masterful. Are you certain you are not French?"
He clenched his buttocks beneath her groin, making her want to vomit.
"I am usually the one to do the riding," he mumbled, "if you know my meaning."
Pistol hidden between her breasts now, Lucilla clutched with her thighs to retain her balance and leaned farther forward, lips touching Gaspar's ear. The smell of his sweat was nauseating.
"Courir sur le haricot," she said.
Literally, run on the bean. The phrase more figuratively meant he had gotten on her last nerve. Gaspar froze, suddenly realizing Lucilla was not who she'd said she was.
"Tu es français," he whispered, face still buried in his towel. "You are French."
Instead of answering, Lucilla dug deep into the muscles of his back with her left elbow. With her right hand, she pressed the MSP against the depression at the base of his neck, just below his skull, aiming downward. She pulled the trigger in perfect time with the resulting grunt brought on by her elbow. Gaspar sagged in the sand, all the air leaving his lungs with a heavy, gurgling groan. His brainstem clipped at the base.
Fini.
Lucilla continued to knead Gaspar's flaccid muscles, chatting amiably. This man had never been anything more than a hollow shell, so it was not at all difficult to talk to him when he was dead. She stopped abruptly, as if he'd said something to her, then tugged at the seat of her panties,
drawing the bodyguard's attention there, away from the blood and bone on the towel where this pig's lower jaw had been. She looked up at Farin.
"He wants some wine," she said, sotto voce, as if she were letting Gaspar drift off to sleep.
Farin scowled. Lucilla gave him a suit-yourself shrug. "I have a bottle in my car if you want to get it." The bodyguard gave a toss of his bulldog head up the hill as if to say, "Get it yourself." She knew that's what he would do, if only to watch her walk away in the torn bikini bottoms. A scant 20 feet below the edge of the cliff where Ding and Midas had set up shop, Jack Ryan Jr. wedged a knife hand into a rock crevice, made a fist, and used the resulting friction to pull himself closer to the face. The pain against his knuckles was a welcome penance. He'd decided to swear off women for a while, at least the conquest of them. Climbing above him, a perfect triangle of perspiration where tight climbing pants met the small of her back, Lizanne Robertson was making the decision difficult. She was pleasant to climb with and behind, but she was also a workmate and friend, certainly not someone he should be fraternizing with. "Don't dip your pen in company ink," Clark had baldly warned everyone after Dominic Caruso and Adara Sherman had become an item. It didn't matter. Ryan had had such shitty luck with women lately that he'd decided to remain celibate in the near term anyway. Lizanne was the better climber and took the lead, picking the route. She moved effortlessly, slowing down for Jack's benefit. He was plenty athletic, getting more than 20 miles a week on the roads around his home in Old Town Alexandria, and at least 2 nights a week with a local soccer league. If climbing were simply a function of strength and size, he should have been able to match this lithe woman pitch for pitch. Fitness was vital, and though Jack's 6-foot-plus wingspan definitely helped, it turned out that climbing had a lot in common with ballet. Lizanne hugged the rock face, stretching her lycra climbing shorts to reach with an incredibly long leg for a toehold as high as her waist. Directly below her, Ryan behaved as a warrior monk and did the gentlemanly thing, turning away to look down at the beach and their target. Ryan had little doubt that Hugo Gaspar was here to meet with the two Russians who had just arrived in the village of Cajafuero, some 5 kilometers along the coast to the west. According to Dom Caruso, the men might as well have had GRU tattooed on their foreheads. The location of the meeting was still up in the air. Caruso and Adara Sherman kept an eye on the Russians, while John Clark kept an eye on them, providing counter-surveillance and protective overwatch. As with the lion's share of campus operations, the road to action had been prefaced with a hell of a lot of reading, analysis, and conjecture, some of it educated, some more along the lines of a wag, or wild-ass guess. Hendley Associates' proximity to the Pentagon allowed the internet gurus of the campus to strain terabytes of raw data in the way of intelligence information from daily encrypted transmissions from Fort Meade. Mary Pat Foley, the Director of National Intelligence and confidant of the President, was fully aware of the broad mission of the campus, but details were kept in-house, giving Liberty Crossing, home of the Director of National Security, and the White House deniability. Sort of. A transmission grab from Creech Air Force Base had shown 11 seconds of footage from an MQ-9 Reaper drone loitering over Helmand, Afghanistan. The video was grainy, but analysts were fairly certain the guy in the picture had gotten his hands on a half dozen Mica rockets. Jack Jr. had worked up the report, identifying the ISIS leader in the video as Faisal al-Zamil, a Saudi national. Or at least he had been, until the Hellfire missile from the MQ-9 had turned him into fine desert shellac. Zamil came from a wealthy family with bank accounts in various locations around Europe. With the help of campus internet savant Gavin Beery, Ryan had been able to follow money from an account in Amsterdam to several pass-through shell companies that would have fooled a casual observer, to a mid-level French arms dealer who thought he was more important than he actually was, named Hugo Gaspar. A tap on the Frenchman's Paris phone had revealed the appointment with the Russians in Portugal. After an unofficial and off-site deconfliction meeting with DNI Foley to be certain that no one from any of her 16 U.S. intelligence agencies were already bird-dogging Gaspar, John Clark brought his little team to the Algarve coast to watch a very tan and wrinkled walrus of a French arms dealer wallow around on the beach with a cute brunette in a black bikini. The girl's leaving. Ryan spoke into the cell phone mic hanging next to his lips. Our rabbit's meeting must be imminent. Maybe, Ding said. Ryan caught a flash of him peering over the edge. Below, the brunette trotted up the trail toward the road. She left her bag and towel behind, Lisanne said. Ding's voice crackled in his ear. I think she saw the drone. Would you stop with that, boss? Midas said. She didn't see... Holy shit. Ryan looked at the girl, running faster now, and Gaspar, still hanging out on his towel. All three bodyguards were slouching by the overturned boat. What? Jack, Midas said. You and Lisanne should keep eyes on the girl. Roger that, Ryan said. Talk to me, Ding said. What are you seeing? Midas held up the drone controller's display. See right here in the upper corner of the screen? Unless I'm mistaken, that's a chunk of Hugo Gaspar's brain in the sand next to what used to be his face. Clinging to the rock with one foot and a fist, Ryan scrambled up and over the edge behind Lisanne. On his belly, he looked down toward the beach in time to see two bodyguards running to their boss, while the third, a short, stocky man, sprinted up the path leading toward town, pistol in hand. She just jumped on a motorcycle, Lisanne said. Got it, Chavez said. A red Ducati heading west, toward Cajavoero. Clark and the others were there. Ryan grabbed the small day pack that held his gear, running toward the rented midnight blue Audi A4. Go with him, Ryan heard Chavez say, half a moment before Lisanne Robertson slid into the passenger seat and slammed the door. And keep your camo on. I want real-time COP. COP was a common operating picture. Their radios had GPS locators that pinged on both Chavez's and John Clark's phones, showing the location of every member of the team superimposed on a map of the area. Ryan started the car while Lisanne took a plastic case the size of a pill bottle from his backpack and popped it open. She poured the tiny flesh-colored earpiece into her open palm and held it out to Ryan. He took it and popped it into his ear at the same time he punched the accelerator, sending up a rooster tail of gravel from the rear tires. Lisanne handed him a loop of copper wire and attached mic, along with a radio about the size of a deck of playing cards. Ryan put the wire over his neck and switched on the radio, clipping it to his shorts as he drove. Check, check, he said. The sound of Midas's voice filled his ear. Have you 5x5? Stay with her, Chavez said, but do not engage. Copy, Ryan said. He pressed the accelerator and cut the wheel to the left, fishtailing into a drift that took him from the parking lot and onto the main road without wasting time on the angle. We should be catching up to her in 2 minutes. Ryan turned to Lisanne, who was working with her own radio. Ryan took another corner at speed, outside, inside, outside, cutting the apex and hearing the tires chatter on the pavement. Still no sign of the red Ducati. He straightened the wheel, shooting another glance at Lisanne. You okay with this? He said. You're not operational. He regretted how superior the words sounded as soon as they left his lips. Fancy driving, she said, putting in the earpiece and ignoring the premise of his comment. They send you to quite a bit of specialized training? Yep, Ryan said. He slid around another corner, catching a glimpse of the bike, and then the gray Mercedes disappear over the crest of a hill ahead. Lisanne settled into her seat. She opened the map on her phone, then turned it toward Ryan, eyebrows up, as if to ask a silent question. He gave her a slight nod. He would drive. She would watch the map and give him the big picture. We're still heading northwest on 1273, she said for the benefit of Jack and the others on the team. Gaspar's bodyguards are right behind the woman, dark gray late model Mercedes sedan. About 1 kilometer ahead. She has lots of choices. Hard to say if she's going inland or is going to cut toward Cajafuero. Jack swerved left, narrowly missing an elderly man out walking with his little white dog beside a hedgerow. The man shook a handful of mail, yelling as they went past. Jack stayed to the center of the narrow road, working through the possibilities. Smart Money says she'll get out of here after a hit. But if she's working for the Russians, she may be running toward reinforcements. Good chance we'll be heading your way, Mr. C.
Chapter 6. It was difficult to say if the row after row of whitewashed hotels and tapas bars spilled down from the cliffs of Cajafuero or crawled back up from the sea. Dominic Caruso and Adara Sherman sat together at a covered table at the Pew Grand Café, one of many restaurants located along the road leading down to the beach. Mournful guitar chords poured from overhead speakers, traditional Portuguese fado, prompting Caruso to sigh.
They must like to be sad here.
I like it, Adara said. They call it saudade, irreparable loss, longing.
No kidding, Dom said. It makes me long for some classic rock. Give me some AC/DC over this stuff any day.
Though they were on surveillance, the chemistry between them was real, so they did not have to pretend to be a couple.
Caruso was a credentialed special agent with the FBI, on loan to the campus. He wore a loose cotton shirt with the sleeves rolled up over strong forearms, khaki slacks, and comfortable lace-up rockports that he could run in.
Adara Sherman was in her mid-30s, with blonde hair that fell just over her ears. Her white shorts and navy blue polo accented her propensity for CrossFit. She'd been Hendley Associates' director of transportation, dealing with travel logistics as well as physical security of the company G5 when it was on the ground. It was the position now held by Lizanne Robertson, a fact that gave hope of eventual promotion to the latter. Sherman was a former Navy corpsman and always had at least a small tactical medics kit within easy reach. The relationship between her and Caruso had happened naturally, and so far at least, they'd proven they could work together without any issues. Caruso told himself that at times like this, the fact that they were a couple made the op even more believable. Clark and Hendley weren't altogether happy about the work relationship, but neither of them tried to put a stop to it. The heart wanted what the heart wanted, even in the intelligence community. There were plenty of operational couples in the FBI and the CIA, though they rarely worked on the same cases. Even Mary Pat Foley, the director of national intelligence, and her husband had been spies together back in the day. Their table at Pew Grand gave Sherman and Caruso a direct line of sight to the covered balcony on the second floor of a tapas bar and restaurant called Casa Iberica. There had been no time to put listening devices in place. In fact, it was little more than luck that they had such a good visual. The two Russians had arrived a half hour before, first getting a table at a small restaurant across the street from Dom and Adara called the Bar Restaurante o Barco. John Clark had walked past, aware that they were probably checking for a tail. He was proven right 5 minutes later when the Russians stood and dropped their menus on the sidewalk table, apparently unable to find anything to their liking. They walked down the ramp to the beach, on the sidewalk just feet away from Dom and Adara, before returning to get a table at Casa Iberica, up the switchback hill from the promenade of shops and restaurants above Cajafuero Beach. Guarding against another turn and burn by the Russians, Clark sat down across the street on the same level as Adara.
Eyes wide, Clark said into the mic on the neck loop under his shirt, as if muttering at his menu.
Dom toyed with a shrimp in his cataplana, a seafood and pork stew.
Copy. Our friends are just sitting there, chatting over their beers.
Adara paused for a beat, waiting to see if Clark responded or if Lizanne came back with a sit rep on where they were with the fleeing motorcyclist.
I'm thinking they're either in the dark about Gaspar, she said, or they are complicit to the hit.
Jack's voice crackled over the net. She's heading right toward you. Makes me think they're probably involved.
Maybe, Clark said with a whispered grunt. I don't see any counter-surveillance, but guys like this will surely have some. We do.
Adara took out her phone and raised it to take a couple of photos of Dom with the sea behind him.
She handed him the phone and let him take some of her. Like a giddy couple on holiday on the Portuguese coast, they put the phone on the table between them and scrolled through the photos, paying special attention to anyone behind either of them that looked out of place. Two men behind Caruso caught their attention. Both were young, raw-boned, with shaggy blonde hair. Their clothing was just ill-fitting enough that it looked like it had been purchased by a distant aunt who'd never met them, or an SVR quartermaster. One of them hid discreetly behind a menu, and the other turned his face. "Watch this, John," Adara said. She motioned a waitress over and asked her to take a photo before sliding her chair around beside Dom. Again, the men ducked their heads. "Got him," Clark said. "Somebody's cage just got rattled." Faringalla pounded on the dashboard with his left hand, his right touching the butt of the Steyr GB pistol at his belt. He was originally from Belgium. 7 years in the French Foreign Legion's Deuxième Régiment Étranger de Parachutistes had ingrained in the bullish thug enough tactical sense not to draw his weapon during a chase. There was too much of a chance the handgun would be dislodged during even a minor fender bender. And anyway, shooting was too good for the bitch. What he really wanted to do was cut her up in tiny little pieces and then step on each piece before feeding them to the crows. It wasn't that she'd killed his boss. There was no love lost for Hugo Gaspar, but this woman had had the balls to kill him right under Farine's nose. There was no way to keep something like that a secret. Word would get out. Good work would dry up and he'd be forced to protect low-level drug dealers, or worse yet, some prima donna actor. No, this little brunette bitch was dead. If he managed to kill her, that might salvage his reputation. At least a little. "Want me to run her over, boss?" Eve, the man behind the wheel, said. "That would be most welcome." Farin nodded at the fleeing Ducati, now fading into the distance. "But would you not have to catch up with her to do that?" Instead of answering, Eve stumped on the accelerator. Farin glanced in the side mirror. The dark Audi loomed larger as it gained on them. They were likely in league with the assassin. Louis and Alain would make short work of them. Alain's voice crackled over the yellow FRS handy-talkie in the seat between Farine's legs. He snatched it up. "Go." "We're in position, boss," Alain said. "Take them," Farine said, "and make an example of it." "Black Peugeot," Lisanne said, "coming up behind us fast." "I see them," Jack said through clenched teeth. He swerved the rental car back and forth, keeping the Peugeot from moving up alongside. He had a Smith & Wesson M&P 9mm in his day pack, but shooting from a moving vehicle at another moving vehicle with a pistol was not just a last resort. It was a waste of meager ammunition. Beyond that, there was little point in relying on 128 grains of lead when he had 3,000 pounds of metal at his fingertips. The guys in the Peugeot didn't understand the concept, because the passenger rolled down his window and leaned out, aiming over dark sunglasses to open up with some kind of SMG. Both Lisanne and Ryan ducked instinctively when a couple of lucky rounds thwacked into the trunk. "We're taking some fire," Lisanne said, her voice matter-of-fact, describing the offending Peugeot over the net for the rest of the team. Jack rolled his shoulders to keep them loose, willing himself not to squeeze the wheel as he continued to swerve the Audi across both lanes. "So much for blending in. Someone is bound to call the cops." "Hang tight." Ding's voice broke squelch on the radio. "We're 3/4 of a mile behind them and gaining." "They're resorting to spray and pray," Ryan said. "But I like their odds if they have enough ammo. Good chance they'll get off a lucky shot by the time you can close the gap." He shifted in his seat, settling in deeper behind the wheel, reaching a conclusion. "I'm going to try something." Ding inhaled so deeply his mic picked up the groan. "Jack, trust me," Ryan said. The machine gun clattered behind them again, this time shattering the Audi's rear window. "I think they're going to try and pit us." Lisanne craned around to look over her shoulder and then up at Ryan, her head cocked to one side, dark brow arched. "So what's your plan?" Jack turned and gave her a quick wink. "I'm going to let them." Eve slowed the Mercedes on the outskirts of Cajafuero. "She disappeared, boss," he said, pushing a lock of blonde mop out of his face and gulping back the croak of failure. "This I can see," Farin said. He slammed a big hand into the dash, a blow he really wanted to deliver to Eve. but that would have made the imbecile run into a utility pole. Get out!
Boss?
Farine's voice grew quiet. Get out of the car and switch seats. I will drive.
They won't get a chance to actually pit us, Jack explained to a slack-jawed Lizanne Robertson, and the others holding their collective breath on the net.
Nah, Lizanne said. They'll just put a few bullets in our skulls.
There's that, Jack said, watching the car behind him grow larger in the rearview mirror after slowing down for a sharp left curve. The guys in the Peugeot had to get lucky only once. For this to work, Jack had to do everything right.
The pit, or pursuit intervention technique, allowed the driver of one vehicle to use his front quarter panel to untrack the rear wheels of a second vehicle while traveling at highway speed. When done correctly, the vehicle on the receiving end simply spun out of the way, allowing the vehicle initiating the pit to continue driving, or as in the case of the guys in the Peugeot, turn around and murder Jack and Lizanne while they sat stuck helplessly in the ditch.
Lizanne leaned forward, craning to see around a white stucco building as they reached the junction with Route 1241 Lagoa and Portimao lay to the right. To the left were Cahafuero and the sea.
I can't see left, she said, but I've got a good view toward Lagoa, and the bike is nowhere in sight.
Ryan punched the gas, shooting around the corner to the left as the black Peugeot rounded the corner 50 meters behind them. Turning toward Cahafuero on 1241, she said over the radio, her calm voice belying her wide-eyed look. Jack brought the Audi out of another tight turn and mashed the accelerator to the floor on a relative straightaway. Houses gave way to tree-covered limestone hills on either side of the road. If he was going to do anything, this was the place.
You know the OODA loop? He asked, without looking up.
Of course, Lizanne said.
The OODA loop described the steps the human brain had to go through in order to take action. Observe, orient, decide, act. An interruption of the process meant starting over, or a costly mistake. Disorient someone. They had to observe again before making a new decision. Change things up as that decision was being made, and the original action was often executed, even if it was wrong.
Well, Jack continued, I'm going to throw a wrench in their loop.
Ding came over the net again.
Can you make it into town?
I show you just a couple of clicks out.
Another volley of fire answered the question. More rounds popped against the Audi's trunk.
Not likely, Jack said.
He tapped the brakes, bringing the speed down to just below 70 miles an hour. His serpentines back and forth across the winding two-lane grew less pronounced, allowing the Peugeot to inch up on the left side. Lizanne slid down in her seat so she could just see out the side mirror.
Now we're down to the nut-cutting, as my father used to say.
Jack, guy on the right is lining up for a shot.
I'm counting on it, Ryan said.
He kept an eye on the Peugeot in the side mirror, holding his breath as the passenger leaned all the way out to take careful aim in the buffeting wind. The guy seemed sure in the knowledge that since Jack was trying to run, he'd just keep running. 20 feet away, 15, then 10, the shooter leaned half his torso out the window. Jack stomped the brakes hard, coming just shy of locking them up. He let off immediately so he maintained control, but the damage was already done. The Peugeot sped past. Metal screamed against metal, catching the hapless shooter and smearing him between the two vehicles with a sickening thump and dragging him out the window of the Peugeot. The decision for his next move already made, Ryan floored the accelerator again before the other driver could reorient. He nosed the Audi up next to the Peugeot's rear tire. Tapping the brakes slightly caused the Audi to squat, stabilizing it as he cut the wheel toward the other car. At nearly 70 miles an hour, it required little more than a kiss to untrack the Peugeot. But Ryan started his pit aggressively, giving the other car a solid nudge. He straightened the wheel immediately after impact. The Peugeot fishtailed to the right, continuing to spin around in front of the Audi, crashing against a low limestone wall facing the other direction and flipping up on its side. Steam poured from the radiator.
And they're done, Lizanne said. She rose half out of her seat so she could get a better look as they flew down the road toward Cajafuera.
Son of a bitch!
It was Midas on the radio, obviously passing a piece of the dead shooter in the road.
That had to hurt.
You guys okay? Ding asked next, checking on his troops.
Good to go,
Ryan said, breathing for the first time in 30 seconds. But the Ducati is in the wind.
Chapter 7 Ryan cut left on a cobblestone road that led into the hills just before entering Cajafuera proper. Distant sirens said the Guardia Nacional was responding to the accident from several directions. The lack of a rear window, as well as an untold number of bullet holes in the Audi's body, made police contact a certainty if they were spotted. Lisanne took the moment of relative calm to change out of the tight climbing shoes and into a pair of Brooks runners from her day pack. They rode on in silence while they worked through the quiet neighborhood of vacation rental villas and down the hill toward town, leaving the radio net to the others. Ryan figured he had a good 15 minutes before the two or three Guarda units stationed in Cajafuera broke loose from the scene and came back into town to look for a dark Audi. Human nature would make them want to stare at the mangled body, at least for a short time. Ryan made a slow right on Rua do Cerro. Trees lined the quiet street, lush and green with new spring foliage. Low limestone walls, thick hedges, and dazzlingly white villas made him wish he were here on vacation instead of on an op.
This is incredible, Lisanne said, her voice hushed as if she were in church.
Ryan stopped at the bottom of the hill, at the intersection with the larger Estrada do Ferrol. Midas and Ding were to the east, waiting to pick them up so they could abandon the Audi, which had been rented under a false ID. What do you think? He looked at Lisanne. Keep looking or turn left? Chavez answered, get your ass over here. Copy that, Ryan said, making the turn. He hadn't gone a half block before Lisanne gave an excited bounce in her seat, humming with sudden emotion. On the left, she said, red Ducati. Ryan slowed, peering up a cobblestone drive alongside a white three-story building with a bar and restaurant on the ground level and two floors of apartments above. The fuel tank and front tire of a red Ducati Monster peeked out from behind a rock wall in back. We might have her, Ryan said, giving their location over the net. She could be in one of the upper apartments. Or the next building, Chavez said. Or across the street. Or just maybe she's abandoned her bike and is at this very moment hauling ass to Lisbon. Your call, boss, Ryan said. But we're sitting right here. I think I should try and get a plate number off the bike. I'll drop Lisanne off here so she can watch the front. Then I'll drive up, take a look, and be down the hill in a flash. I'll pick up Lisanne and we'll be out of here in 2 minutes, maybe less.
2 minutes, Chavez said. We'll head your way.
Dominic Caruso asked the waitress for a touch more Foral de Porchamel, an inexpensive local red that she'd recommended. Adara reached across the table and gave his hand a squeeze, prompting him to follow her gaze over his shoulder. Our friends on Overwatch are starting to get antsy, she said, once the waitress had poured the wine and left. Clark came over the radio. I see that. Adara smiled at Dom, chatting away about the weather, the beach, anything but a surveillance on a couple of Russian spooks. She gave a play-by-play so he didn't have to turn around. One of them just clouded up like he saw something he didn't like. He's standing now. I think he's about to head across the street. Nope. Scratch that. Now he's sitting back down. Must be in Kama with his Ruski friends, Dom said. He scanned the balcony for anything out of the ordinary. I think I see what's going on. Care to enlighten us? Clark said. There's a new player, Dom said. Tall, jeans, tan sport coat with the sleeves pushed up like he's auditioning for a remake of Miami Vice. Dark hair cut over his ears. Big honking watch I can see from here. He was just standing in the doorway watching a minute ago. I thought he was looking for someone. He's making his way toward the Russian's table now. There's no one else seated at that end of the balcony. That must be what spooked our friends here. One of Gaspar's men? Clark offered. Could be, Dom said. He's sitting at the table with the Russians. Hard to tell from this distance. But they don't look very happy to see him.
Urbano da Rocha made his move the moment he received the call from Lucila. He'd had no doubt of her abilities, but things happened, and he did not care to be caught in a meat grinder between Hugo Gaspar and the two Russians who were about to become his friends. "Allo," he said, giving